For the House Judiciary Committee at 10 minutes after 1. Present, we have Representative James, Bundy, Berkowitz, and Green. And I know Croft is close.
He's out in the hall.
We have just one bill today, which is kind of surprising. We'll have Senate Bill 8 amended. And we have the Representative Rochberg has joined us. And it's a noise bill. Do we have someone from the
noise department?
Sponsor? There he is.
Anybody have any noise?
Noise is off.
Would you please identify yourself for the record, please, and tell us about your bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Brett Huber. I'm staff to Senator Halford, prime sponsor of SBA. You should have included in your committee packets for today a sponsor statement, zero fiscal note, sectional analysis, and various letters of support. Senate Bill 8 has been introduced to provide protection for existing sports shooting ranges and private airports from nuisance lawsuits based on noise level. Although this has not yet proven to be a significant problem in Alaska, numerous sports shooting ranges and private airport facilities in the lower 48 have found themselves in the situation of facing a lawsuit filed by someone who has moved into the area of an established operation and later decides they don't like the noise. Mr. Chairman, this issue was addressed by the 19th legislature at the passage of Senate Bill 274. SB 274 passed the legislature by a wide margin before being vetoed. During the committee review of the legislation in the Senate, several concerns were raised by the Alaska Municipal League and the Department of Law, Department of Community and Regional Affairs. The sponsor worked with the Department of Law, AML, and DCRA to address these concerns and took care of them with a Senate floor amendment. You'll note in your packet also letters from AML and DCRA confirming that their concerns were indeed addressed. Mr. Chairman, also in your packet, you should have letters from the National Rifle Association, Alaska Air Carriers Association, the Alaska Airmen's Association, the Outdoor Council, and the Alaska Boaters Association endorsing the legislation. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation of the bill. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions of the yes, Representative Bundy?
Not a question as much as a comment. I would make an offer to the bill sponsor for whatever it might be worth. I understand that in Colorado, I believe it was, they had similar legislation. And part of the legislation required that when someone brought suit against a airport or a rifle range for the noise problem, reducing the values of the property, the notification that this property value may have been reduced by the existence of this suit was required to be available when that property then was up for sale. It's an interesting philosophy. Someone brings a nuisance suit, you reduce the value of my property by your noise. Now when you go to sell that property, you must notify potential buyers that you feel this value of this property has been reduced. I just offer that as a suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Excuse me, Representative Croft.
Good to see you. Brett, to some extent, carrying on a conversation we had just before the hearing, I'm generally supportive of the bill. It makes a lot of sense to me. I remember being confused about the coming to the nuisance idea in law school. Though there are certain justifications for it, kind of counterintuitive. I was curious about then, still am now, what level of activity goes on to give the people who are coming to it notice. Can these be defunct airports and shooting facilities? And if so, what is the substantial change in the use that we're talking about? If it's a non-operating shooting range and I buy near it, what notice do I have of the noise level that's going to come? And when it starts, is that a substantial change in the use of the facility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, as defined in the bill, substantial change in the use of the facility was that was part of what the Senate floor amendment dealt with, and that was adding sub 3 on page 2, line 6, substantial change in the use facility, and then the definition or qualifiers for substantial change in the use are found on page 2, line 28, continuing on page 3. The situation you're asking about is if a shooting range is perhaps temporarily shut down, and that's the time that you acquire the property, and then the shooting range begins operation again. And it is the intent of this legislation and the sponsor to basically grandfather those facilities in that were in there, that were in use, whether they're in use at that specific time or whether they come back into use. And the discussion we were having in the hall was, it's not uncommon up here for a landowner to develop a piece of ground and build a house on it and then build a private airstrip. He may at some point in time choose to or need to sell his aircraft. He may also have other lots for sale adjacent to this airstrip. If he was the only user of the airstrip and he sold his aircraft, that basically caused an interruption in the use of the facility, but the facility was still there. As you sell adjacent pieces of property and you have two or three aircraft coming back, it is the sponsor's intent that that is still a facility that ought to be afforded the protection that this bill offers from the noise nuisance suits. I think it is important to note, however, that this deals only with noise nuisance. If there are any other types of safety concerns or any other type of nuisance action, this does not exempt those facilities from those, only noise.
Representative Croft.
Thank you. Poorly raised question before, and I apologize. We are talking about the issue I'm concerned about, and I guess it comes down to the definition of established facility. What it takes to make a facility established, and is there a period of lack of use that makes it no longer established? And I see a 3-year time limit under, you have a definition on line 17 through 21 in this section, established means. But above on line 10, we talk about if the facility was established before the person acquired the property. Part of my confusion was if established only refers in this section, that is on line 17, in this section established means, it's not the same definition that we would use in established on line 10. That's outside of the section.
Correct.
So what is an... It makes a lot of sense to me that if I move next door to an established shooting facility, I shouldn't be able to complain about the shooting that's going on there unless it substantially changes in character. But then the rub is, what is established? If it's a facility that was 3 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, used as a shooting facility, I don't have the same sort of notice and I guess not the same degree of comfort with the bill as I do if it's going on there. I can hear it, I can know what I'm buying. So I'm trying to get whether there's a way to give this notice that makes it reasonable, I think, in most of our view, that that you not be able to sue for something you knew was there. The question is, how do you know they're there? So why isn't, what is an established facility under the other one? Something that was at any time used?
And you're correct, the definition of established facility applies just to the time limitation on when suit may be brought.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
Do you think the sponsor would have, and I don't want to put you on the spot, an objection to some sort of similar definition of established for this other section? It'd be similar, I guess the 3 years makes sense to me, but that if something had not been used for 3 years, it's not an established facility when I move next door to it. If it's been unused for that long, just as if it's been unused for that long here, it provides the time limit, but if it's been unused for that long, I don't have the same reasonable notice of it. If it's been used any time in the last 3 years, then it's an established facility. If it hasn't, then it's not for nuisance purposes.
Representative Cross, through the chair. I believe the sponsor would have a problem with bringing in that 3-year time limit, and probably not so much as this bill applies to shooting ranges, but it's this bill applying to shooting ranges and private airstrips. I think there's, then again, you have an airstrip on the ground someplace that, that you can see that an airstrip's in place. And I understand your concern about notice, but I believe that then you'd have the opportunity to argue that resuming activity would fall under the change in the use of the facility exemption that is provided, which basically puts it back in the hands of the courts whether they believe that this action is something that can be brought and is something that they're going to be heard.
Brief follow-up on that point.
Follow-up?
That's interesting, and that may cure the problem by us putting that on the record. I hadn't thought of it that way. So if something had not been used for a long period of time, the resumption may be a substantial change in use?
Could be, but it wouldn't necessarily be.
Right, and I would say that that would merely offer a chance to argue and present that side to the courts, and who are ultimately going to construe what this definition is. And I think it's important to note that substantial change in the use, it says right in the phrase, shall be strictly construed to maximize the immunity, and shall not, does not include a mere increase in the frequency of flights or number of shots. I mean, it's certainly the sponsor's intent to provide as much protection as possible for those facilities that have been used for this activity in the past, so they can continue to be used for this activity as long as noise is the only concern. But again, if there are other concerns outside of noise, this bill doesn't address those. Those nuisance actions, no ordinance, municipal ordinances or zoning possibilities are all still there with the exception of noise nuisance specifically.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a little problem with a three-year limitation, knowing how long it can take to manufacture if you're a home builder, or rebuild if you're a tinker, an aircraft. And I could see that you could own a private airstrip, take it upon yourself to do sweat equity, rebuild an airplane, and easily take 3 years to do that. And maybe then that is not used regularly in that interim. But there is a, and I don't know what the legal term is, adverse possession or something, where if you have a trail across someone's property and you have to drive on it once every so often, or if someone has it, if you've allowed someone access to your property, you have to block the trail off at certain intervals every few years to establish your ownership and to keep from grandfathering in. Is this the sort of thing that the question was getting at, that if an airplane touches down there once every 3 years, it is a continuing use? If someone goes out and target practices once a year at a rifle range, is that continuing use? That's the, I guess, the answers that I would be looking for.
Senator Berkowitz?
There's a couple of factual things that I'm curious about. There, to your knowledge, have there been any suits of this nature up here?
Mr. Chairman, request to my knowledge, no.
To that point, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bundy?
I believe in Eagle River, there's a fellow that had a Pioneer airstrip, wanted then to develop the lots and sell them around there, and he did run afoul of neighbors who said it hadn't been used as an airstrip for a number of years, and so would not, it was in court as to whether that could happen or not, or at least before planning
is over. And Mr. Chairman, to qualify my answer, the sponsor has not researched, has this ever happened before, but it's, the bill did not come forward with the intent of remedying a specific situation. The bill came forward with the idea of being proactive to a situation that's happened in areas in the lower 48 that have urbanized and spread faster than they have here.
Representative Berkowitz?
On that subject, the areas that have gone through this in the lower 48, what has happened with those suits? Have they been upheld? The people who are coming to the nuisance, have their positions been upheld generally?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, my understanding is generally the suits have been resolved in favor of the existing facility. However, that's after time and money is put out by the facility that's in existence. So it's not necessarily to the only penalty is not just being having the case found against you. It's also just the time and money and effort involved in the actual litigation itself.
Representative Croft.
Maybe answering that question, on page 2, lines 10 and 11, the prohibition on the nuisance says, unless the facility substantially changes the use of the facility after the person acquires the property. So in our troublesome facts we were playing with, if it hadn't been used much, it depends on when I buy, I guess. If I buy at a period of high use, that's the type I have notice of and that can't change. If I buy in a period of little use, that's the reference point. It seems like you're tying, and probably appropriately, the thing we're measuring the change from was when you bought the property.
Okay. Representative Cross, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that in listening to this discussion here, it's very interesting because, and I know of cases in the lower 48 where they have made really a lot of trouble for airports, particularly. And I believe that after a lot of trouble that the airport survived the challenge. But these are two issues in Alaska. I think this is a very important piece of legislation. And these are two issues in Alaska as we get more and more people moving into the area that I think we need to protect. For one, and that's why I would be willing to go a little further out on the limb for airports and for shooting facilities or shooting ranges, is because that you can't build an airport just anywhere. And if you don't have one, you can't hardly get one from here either. And so in Alaska, where air transportation is an extremely important issue for us, it seems to me like the ability to maintain the places that we have is very important. So, and then the same is true with a shooting range. If you don't have any out there, it's really difficult to get one unless you go so many miles away that you almost have to camp out overnight. So I think that and I don't know what the law would be, but it seems to me like these two issues are different than a lot of other issues that we might have of noise. And so therefore I think it should have an exceptional immunity as opposed to other things because of our lifestyle that we have up here. So I don't know if that could be any part of this or not, but I wanted to be sure that at least I say that I think these two are specific kinds of issues that need to be protected in Alaska for Alaska's lifestyle. I think it's appropriate that we bring them forth now before we have some of these same problems they've had in the lower 48. The ones cases in the lower 48 that I'm aware of was attacks on fairly large airport facilities. I think there was one even on the Portland airport. There were people who built subdivisions that were not too far from the airport, and they knew very well the airport's been there a long time, big airport, big planes, all those kinds of things, and they didn't really have a clue till they moved in as to how much noise there would be. And you know, that's they should know better than that, I think, is the situation. But I don't know if there's any way to put the importance of this community into the legislation, or just putting it on the record is important.
Representative Berkowitz.
There's something else that I guess we haven't focused on yet is, to what extent does this interfere with the municipality's ability to regulate its own areas within its own jurisdiction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, municipal ordinance, basically the immunities that this bill offers the facilities from nuisance noise action, it also offers for municipal ordinance. And that was the item of contention and where the concern from the AML and CRNA came from. Again, it limits only their ability to control these facilities specifically by noise ordinance, not for safety concerns, not if other buildings in the area or some other change in the area changes traffic pattern for a runway, not if there's safety concerns on the shooting facility, not if it doesn't exempt them from the laws and of zoning. It does, however, grandfather these facilities in to subsequent noise control ordinances that would be offered at the municipal level. And that's why the substantial change in the use of the facilities exemption was added on the Senate floor.
Follow up, Representative Berkowitz.
I just want to be clear, then, the municipality would still be free to regulate based on a health or safety criteria.
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir.
Representative Croft?
No, thank you. That answered it.
Brett, back on this issue of non-use for a period of time, if a insomniac or someone who is a light sleeper were to move in, for example, into my area, I'm not that far from a shooting range. That wouldn't be evident from the highway, and certainly wouldn't be evident if somebody were coming out to look at the property from downtown. They're staying at the Captain Cook and looking for a place to buy. They really wouldn't know that that shooting range was there, especially if it weren't being used for a period of time. Would this then eliminate any possibility of redress for that person when that thing starts back up again in 3 years?
It would certainly eliminate the possibility of redress through a noise nuisance action. Yes, sir.
Representative James?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for Representative Roepberg, since he's real familiar with real estate transactions. Is that one of the things that would be required of the real estate agent to notify the people of when he's doing all of his notifications of problems? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not a residential realtor, but the legislature has seen fit to impose a disclosure statement on the alienation of any real estate, and I would believe that that would be a requirement. That if there were any activity such as that in that particular area, that it would have to be disclosed, if not required in a disclosure statement, at least as a matter of ethics, to be disclosed.
Well, ethics maybe. I would take issue with the fact that I wouldn't have to disclose anything other than that was on my property, other than perhaps ethically. But this thing hasn't been used. It's year 2.5, and for all practical purposes, it's shut down. It's out of business, and Fred McGillicuddy comes in and wants to re-up that thing. It doesn't seem to me that the landowner would be, or the property owner would be required to disclose that. It's not being used now.
Six months later,
after I've sold it, then this guy starts to bang away again, and it is noticeable, even though I'm a half a mile away from it. It follows the tracks down and comes up the bluff, and it's noticeable. I don't mind it. It was there before I was there, but someone else might. Representative Roepberg.
Yeah, I was going to add, Mr. Chairman, that if this bill were to pass, and I hope it does, there may well be a duty, as I say. I'm almost certain that the disclosure requirements would require disclosure, but if this bill passed, if the timing could speak to that too, and therefore put a burden on a realtor to disclose that, if it was conceivable that legally it could resurrect itself, if you will. But it depends on how far earshot is and so forth. I don't know if there's been anything on the record. I might ask the bill sponsor's assistant here. Brett, has there been anything on the record about is it the noise, the dB level that we're talking about, or has there been a geographic boundary or something that has come into play, or has there been any discussions about that?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, there really hasn't. The bill doesn't deal specifically with noise decibel level or with proximity to the facility. That discussion has not occurred.
Follow up, Representative Roper.
Apparently, it uses good common sense to use a good common sense standard. But Mr. Chairman, if I could just to clarify two things for the record and myself, because I do live in the shadow of the sound of the Anchorage International Airport, and my district does include the Lake Hood area and the strip that's spoken to in the attached report from the Airmen's Association, also adjacent to Representative Rokowitz's and we all have concerns here. As a matter of fact, this bill will not affect the operations of any municipally or state-owned airport, is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
And therefore, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, the airstrip that's referred to in the Alaska Airmen Association letter here about proposed real estate legislation would not really come into play, because the strip at Lake Hood, that's a land strip, is on a state-owned property, is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is also correct.
Which means when my constituents complain about this bill, I can say it doesn't affect that particular strip. And Mr. Chairman, I actually posed this question to Norm. You might remember that. I actually posed this question more or less to Representative Bundy. There's a strip on the hillside area that's a land wheel strip that has been there in a number of years. But I'm kind of concerned that if we're talking about substantial changes of use, I can conceive of not necessarily the frequency, but the going from a private utilization into some type of commercial utilization. Is anybody aware of whether if you change that use, then either the municipality, FAA, or somebody else has jurisdiction over the commercial use of a private strip? Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bundy.
Well, that is commercially used now in that they rent tie-downs there to for people who do not own property immediately adjacent to that strip. It's been used commercially for 20 years as far as, if you define commercially as that they do have a business there. There have been maintenance facilities and tie downs for rent there.
Mr. Chairman, if I might pursue that to the bill sponsors, would, for example, that strip on the hillside in Anchorage, if there was an air taxi operation that commenced operations out of that strip, do you know whether that would be covered either as a substantial use, change of use, and or would there be other authorities that would come into play there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, the discussion on substantial use, a great deal of it was had in the Senate Resources Committee, where actually the sponsor brought forward a CS that incorporated the substantial change in use, and the concern of the Resource Committee was we need a definition of substantial change in use that deals with a situation where you have a private airstrip that you're flying single engine recreational flights out of, whether you fly touchdown and take off three times a day or six times a day, and the sponsor's opinion shouldn't matter, but substantial change in use was included, because if you have a facility like the strip you're talking about, it's then extended, it's then paved, and then you have multi-engine cargo flights flying out of it, that obviously is a substantial change in use and something that ought to be addressed through noise nuisance action or by municipal ordinance. I believe merely taking money for the flight, as long as you don't have a substantial change in use, is going to ultimately be determined by the court when the action is brought. But I think just taking money for the flight, if it's still single engine, same type of aircraft, same type of use, is not probably going to make a substantial difference.
Representative James?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sponsor, just the thought has occurred to me, and thinking about the way this is going to be implemented, that maybe it might be wise, particularly in the area of shooting ranges and or small airports, to put in a period of time that it would sit idle, which would say then starting it back up would not be a good idea. And my reason for that is that if we had a time in there, people who wanted to protect their place from being ungrandfathered, shall we say, will be sure that that time doesn't lapse.
Representative Berkowitz.
A couple questions about sport shooting facilities. Do you know roughly how many private sport shooting facilities we're talking about statewide?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz, I don't know that number off the top of my head, no.
Are we talking dozens, hundreds? Yes?
I would think that we're probably more in the category of dozens.
Yeah, there are certainly not enough in the Anchorage Bowl, I know that.
Right. Well, there's some parts of the state that I wasn't sure about. So. And these are, to your knowledge, are they subject to licensing, municipal or state licensing requirements?
I know of no state licensing requirements. I believe municipalities handle them in different ways.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I can think of two in the Anchorage Bowl, if that's just add to the discussion. One that everyone probably knows about is out at Birchwood, but then just up at Plutino Ways, I just have had occasion to be there, and there are a fellow on this private property very consistently was apparently target practicing because shoots a lot of ammunition there. Yeah.
There's one on south part of town too.
Well, that but that's state.
Yeah.
He
was asking.
Private.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And Isaac Walton is a private, and this fellow, and so, you know, a lot of homesteads probably may have their own little target range where they shoot once or twice a year to sight in. On the notion of substantial change, I think for the record, I'd like to say my perception is that helped define this three-year thing that if there had been a lack of activity for more than 12 months, then the activity changes, then I would, in my mind, say that that was a substantial change. I tried to allude to a little earlier what Representative James has just mentioned, and that is, again, that notion, I don't know if it's adverse possession or whatever the rules of law are, that if you want to change the use of a piece of property, you have to, on a yearly or whatever, my understanding is once a year, establish your ownership or establish that trail is not public property or whatever, to maintain your ownership of that. And I could see a very similar situation where if you have a shooting range or a private airport, that once a year it would not be unexpected that you take a few shots or land your airplane. Have a few shots after that.
Videotape it with a date.
Yes, Representative Berkowitz. Oh, excuse me.
Croft.
I'd just like to put a conflict on the record. I'm a member of the Isaac Walton shooting range, and I think it's a membership thing that may affect their ongoing operations. So to the extent it's a conflict, I wanted to put it on the record.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brad, did the bill sponsor consider the recommendations of the Airmen's Association about having this notification in the letter that's in the package? Did you even take that up? It would have broadened this bill substantially, but did he consider it adopting anything along this line in the course of the discussions?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, that letter actually was accompanying a letter of support for the bill as drafted, and I think inadvertently was included in the committee packet. Yes, Senator Halford has talked with the drafter of the letter and the organization, and they're further researching whether that perhaps would be subsequent legislation that he would like to file. But it would be the sponsor's intent, if addressing that issue, to do it in separate legislation.
And Mr. Chairman, regarding Mr. Representative Bundy's comment, adverse possession, I think historically under common law was about a 7-year period, either constructively or actively, but I'm not sure what the present status in state law of that is.
5 in California.
Varies. Maybe our in-house guys can help us.
7 and 10.
7 and 10, right. I was right. The to the chair, Brett, I guess one thing that I've been thinking about is I had an opportunity to fly in on a CASA 24, which is a dual-engine plane well adapted for the bush use, into the Tlalchilitnan Lodge a number of years ago. I thought I was on a kamikaze trip. Never have I seen such a big plane with a lot of people in it. This guy in this little tiny strip. It was amazing. At any rate, I can see a dual-engine aircraft that was particularly suited for that short field landing type capabilities going into, and I can see where this, a lot of private strips exist at lodges and so forth throughout the state where there's no other municipal regulation or anything. But, I guess a concern I have is that are you aware of any kind of environmental causes of action as it relates to lawsuits that could be brought by people in the environmental community to stifle the growth, and whether this would be have any impact at all? Has there been any testimony or anything that you're aware of in that line that would create a cause of action in a more or less wilderness area where this may be helpful? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brokberg, that hasn't been a topic of discussion on the bill, and I know of no. I don't know if you're asking if.
Well, someday we'll have the EPA's version of the national noise abatement statute probably have to deal with. Also, another question here, just for the record, is a friend of mine has got a biplane that's got a reciprocating engine, or like a de Havilland Beaver has a different kind of engine than, let's say, the more common Cessnas and other aircraft nowadays that are single engine type. That's one loud type engine. So if you change the type of aircraft engine, would that be a substantial use from a Cessna 206 to a Beaver?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, I think it's important to note that the sponsor's intent with this bill was clearly a lot in line with Representative James' comments that flying airplanes and sport shooting in Alaska are activities that are important to the state. They're historical activities and activities that the sponsor believes ought to be able to be preserved and continue to be enjoyed. This bill clearly sets up to provide the maximum immunity possible for those type of facilities. So no, we would not interpret substantial change to mean that this is a reason for the owners of those facilities to have to endlessly justify whether it was a bore prop or not on the last plane that touched down at the Strip.
Senator Berkowitz?
All I can say is that, you know, after serving here in the legislature just for these few short months, my notion of excessive volume has expanded considerably.
With or without props?
No props necessary, it seems.
Well, I can understand where a Beaver would shake the houses as opposed to another single engine plane, but it's still, if it's in a used facility, I can understand there'd be some perhaps irritation, but yet that's what it was for when you came in. But my concern still is the idled airstrip or shooting lodge that has been down for something less than 3 years, but the duty that goes with the land use or the sale of the land use and the immunity that would be afforded to somebody coming in and not being aware of that it was going to start up again or ever. I think you alluded to something along that line, Representative James, and I think that would probably exacerbate that concern a lot. But I don't think it would make the sponsor very happy.
Well, I don't think it would make the sponsor happy either. I'm just saying that if you had a deadline, people would meet it. If you don't have one, they might accidentally not. I was thinking of it as a protection measure more than I was to restrict the and I don't know what those time frames were. But while we're talking, I'm thinking of someone who has a personal, private shooting range where it's a family thing, and they do this, and they've been doing it for years, and all of a sudden the person who does most of the shooting gets ill for a while and can't go out and do it, and then all of a sudden now he's been sick for a while, now he can't go, goes out to do it, and all of a sudden somebody files a lawsuit against him because he's making noise. Because they have a new neighbor down the street somewhere. I don't know but what that, and thinking about that just for more protection, and I be yield to any concerns that anybody would have, that if we put in a time frame when there is no use, that then people would know that, and they would know that they would have to reestablish their use within this period of time, and he could have brought his neighbors in then to go out and do shooting, in other words, to keep it in use. I know that's subverting the law in a certain sense. However, it's been done for years, and people do that. The fact is, I've known people to move into an area and do some business because of it being grandfathered, and they have to do it. If they don't, then they lose their grandfather right. So I don't know that that's a bad idea, necessarily. I just, whatever it takes to protect these spaces, and actually what I'm thinking that we ought to be protecting is the space that is set aside here for this. This is an airstrip set aside and amongst all of these things for an airstrip, and has been here for a long time, and if only one time a year a plane lights down, it should be able to do that. And if they happen to buy a new plane, they got two planes now and they want to put two of them down, they should be able to do that. The same thing is true with the shooting ranges. It's something that you have to be far enough, it has to meet some certain criteria before it can ever be one. And once you've established that area somewhere and it's private property, not public property, private property, it seems to me like that it should be grandfathered in, and whatever it takes to maintain that grandfather rights, usually in other grandfather rights on real property, it is as long as that person owns the property, he has that grandfather right. And I might even like to put it in there that it is a grandfather right. You know, I don't want to have this so loose that doesn't do anything, and I don't want to have it so tight that it is too restrictive. But it seems like there ought to be some way in there that we can specifically say we're protecting this piece of private property for this use, no matter who else comes about and wants to change it, that they can't sue for noise because they are noisy things.
Mr. Chairman, I'd respond. It seems that the main concern of the committee is what kind of time frame, what if something is that idle. I can tell you that sub 3 was incorporated into section 1 to bring in those type of unique or peculiar circumstances, a substantial change in the use of the facility. The definition of established and the time frame for bringing suit that's addressed in the following says established includes resuming shooting activity to support facility if there's not been shooting at the facility for 3 or more years. It's certainly not the sponsor's intent to mandate use of this facility at certain intervals. However, if you buy property during that time the shooting range is not being used, after that time the shooting range comes back in line, as long as you make your pitch, try to bring your suit to the court that says I'm within the 5 years after this facility reestablished operation and qualified under the definition of established, it brings the question down to substantial change in use. And then I think you're gonna find arguing what was the historical use versus the use at the time it resumed. Is there a substantial change in use? And that's the reason for sub 3 in the bill, to handle unique and different circumstances. But it's certainly the sponsor's intent to have these facilities that are in existence stay in existence, not to grandfather those spaces, because there are other concerns that might happen. You might have a flight plan problem. You might have another health or safety concern that's raised. And if those legitimate concerns are out there, then these facilities are going to have to fend as they can under the new circumstances they're in. But for noise specifically, this bill certainly intended to provide the maximum immunity if possible to those facilities.
Senator Berkowitz?
I just want to be clear, with substantial change in the use, not including a mere increase in the frequency of flights or the number of shots, what you mean by that is that shouldn't be the exclusive criterion used to evaluate whether substantial change has occurred?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, yes. What that means is if there were 4,000 shots a week fired at the Sporting Clay facility, and now the business is becoming more successful, there are no more members, and now they're firing 6,000 shots a week, that alone should not meet the substantial change.
But that could be used in concert with some additional facts. For example, and it'll be real extreme, all of a sudden they decide to open between midnight and 3 in the morning.
Put in a hand grenade range.
Then I think that
semi-automatic.
That then you make the case basically in bringing the suit why you believe there's been a substantial change. This is just providing direction to the court that merely an increase in frequency of shots or flights is not sole justification as a substantial
standing,
change.
And what I want to be clear on is standing by itself, but it can be used if you combine it with other factors.
I would think that, and Mr. Chairman, I would think that, other factors and any other angle possible that you could think of when putting the suit together, Representative Berkowitz.
Okay. I'm not putting the suit together. So
We have about four people that have signed up to testify. Maybe they can shed some light and open up some other questions. From the Mat Sioux, we have Robert Larson.
Yes, how are you today?
We're just fine, sir, except we lost our sunshine.
Well, we've got a little bit of it here, but not too much. It's getting better, though. I sure want to thank you folks for hearing me today. It's not something that I'm accustomed to doing. However, I felt compelled when I read that this legislation was pending that I take part in letting you know what my feelings are and some of the experiences I've had. I'm a longtime Alaskan, and I'm involved in all of the pursuits that make noise, such as flying and sport shooting and hunting, et cetera, and so on. Of course, I'm a user. I wanted to let you know that my wife and I, we certainly support passage of the Senate Bill number 8, and we would like to see some protection afforded to shooting ranges and airstrips. And along with that, I'd like to pass on to those of you who probably weren't here to remember the Sand Lake Gun Club in Anchorage. That gun club was shut down utilizing noise as an excuse to obtain property. And I'd be happy to relate the tale of exactly how that happened if anybody wants to, but some of you probably remember and some of you probably shot at the old Sand Lake Gun Club. Its location was very close to the airport. The noises of the jets were at least as noisy as the gunshots, and there was 25 very valuable acres. And the legalities of pay the taxes on this leased piece of property. And I just wanted to relate my feelings in this regard, because I know you're working detail to this bill, but there are sometimes motives, maybe selfish, that need to be considered, we need to guard against. And I don't know what else to say other than I support passage of Senate Bill 8, and my wife and I both do, and there's another fellow here that would probably like to get his 2 bits worth in along with me. Do you have any questions of what I've said so far?
Any questions, members of the panel? Yes, Representative Bundy.
No question, just an apology. As someone who is familiar with the Sand Lake Gun Club and its story, I should have brought that up for the committee. I've forgotten what a nice place that was.
Yes, and I think you probably are aware of how it got shut down, et cetera, and so on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lark. Are there any other questions? Representative Rochford.
That's where I was going to say that site is just a few blocks from my home, and I recall it well. It's now the area occupied what's called Sportsman's Point, probably the most exclusive neighborhood in the city of Anchorage. Residential.
Is the compadre there with you, Lloyd Weber?
Yes, I am. Thank you for letting me speak. I pretty much concur with what Bob Larson just told you. I do have one question as to whether you've gone far enough in protecting the float plane operators. I can see the same thing happening on our lakes. And a good example is Wasilla Lake. A lot of restrictions have been brought about that location. Not pertaining so much as to airplanes, but I'm a shooter, a hunter, and I've also been involved in aviation. For 25 years I've been in Alpine, Alaska. And I've been aware of noise abatement for some time in aviation, and I see its encroachment becoming a pretty grave concern to airplane owners. And I support the passage of Senate Bill 8, and that's pretty much all I have to say.
Any questions, Mr. Weber? Thank you, Lloyd. That's all I have signed up there. Is there anyone there with you?
That's it.
Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. That brings us back to Anchorage. We have Robert Regis.
Juneau.
Uh-huh. Oh, I'm sorry, Juno. Pardon me.
Thank you, Mr.
Don't
Chair.
You wish.
Yeah.
My name is Robert Regis, and I'm with the Department of Law. I came particularly to talk about one issue, but before I touch on that, I thought maybe I'd bring to fore a few cases that I had at my fingertips, which might at least address some of the questions or concerns that were raised earlier. On substantial change in use, I would suggest, if anybody's interested, there's an interesting case out of Wisconsin, Kruger versus Mitchell, 332 Northwest 2nd, 733. In Kruger, it involved an airport, and there the plaintiff had a business, and the old airport was not paved, and it had a different alignment than the new runway. The owner of the airport realigned the runway and paved it, and the court did decide that that was a nuisance, and their main reasoning was because it channeled the aircraft directly over the plaintiff's business, whereas before they were off to the side. So there's some example, at least one example of an aircraft change in use. Didn't involve different planes or anything like that, but I thought it was interesting on that score of substantial change in use. Sort of jumping back and forth between topics here because it's hard to keep them all in the order that they came down. The question was discussed as to who the EPA or who else might have control over noise from the federal regime. And that's actually the FAA. There is an interesting United States Supreme Court case regarding noise from airports. City of Burbank versus Lockheed Air Terminal. The City of Burbank is at 411 U.S. 624, a 1973 case out of the United States Supreme Court. And the bottom line is that most noise controls over airports are preempted by the federal FAA. Because most efforts to control noise at airports involve regulating hours when planes can land or take off, regulating size of aircraft, and so on and so forth. And the FAA obviously has a vested interest in controlling that and not allowing localities to do that. I raised those two cases in the same breath because in the Kruger case, they analyzed to some great length the Lockheed case and decide that a local plaintiff is not preempted when he's seeking damages from the airport owner. In their case, the plaintiff was allowed to get money damages for the diminution in value to his real property. He was not allowed to enjoin the aircraft activity because the injunctive relief that he sought was, in fact, preempted by the federal government. So that's one example of the compromises that you see in the courts. You can't stop the planes from coming and going because maybe they have a connection somewhere else. But you can get some money damages, and it goes back to your comment about diminution in property value. As far as shooting range cases go, there's some interesting cases out of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, in the midst of several cases, adopted a law quite similar to the one that you're considering today. These cases were not dispositive. I think the question on the floor earlier was, what has happened in the lower 48 when people have complained, when brought nuisance actions? What has the outcome been? Each of these two cases that I'm going to bring to your attention were remanded, so we don't know what ultimately happened, but originally the landowners were able to prevail on injunctive relief, and then in the course of their litigation, in the course of the appeals, the Pennsylvania legislature adopted a bill similar to this. And so both cases were sent back to the courts to be revisited in light of the bill. But the cases at issue are Gray versus Barnhart, 601 Atlantic 2nd, 924. That's a 1992 case out of Pennsylvania. And Soja versus Factoryville Sportsman's Club, 610 Atlantic 2nd, 491, also a 1992 case out of Pennsylvania. So those are some interesting cases just to see, well, in the absence of this bill, in the absence of these sorts of protections, yes, in fact, the property owners, even those who came to the nuisance, even those who moved in after the fact, after the gun club was established, were able to prevail and to do what apparently happened at Sandpoint, which was limit the hours on which shooting took place. And then they were remanded. But the one case that, this leads in, segues into the topic I came to talk about, which is the coming to the nuisance topic. The most, the seminal case on that in the United States actually is out of Arizona, involving two heavy hitters there, Spur Industries versus Del Webb, 494 P2nd 700. If any of you go down to play golf in Phoenix, you probably are familiar with Del Webb, Sun City West. And when Mr. Webb started to build Sun City West, the area was a cattle fattening farms. I don't know the proper term, but feedlots, cattle feedlots. Needless to say, the retirees who were moving to Phoenix didn't cotton much to living next door to a feedlot. So Mr. Webb and the Spur Industries had some difficulties. And Mr. Webb was coming to the nuisance. The feedlots were there first. What the Arizona Supreme Court did was say, well, times are changing in Phoenix. You can't be a feedlot anymore. But after all, you were, so we'll allow Mr. Webb to bring this case because we're not going to bar him from bringing the case just because he was the last one, he came to the nuisance. But we are going to take that into account in the remedy. Mr. Webb, you have to find a new home for the feedlot. And you have to help the new owner, or the owner get, acquire the property that you found. So what they did, that's why it's the seminal case, is they thought, well, it's really how we fashion the remedy. You know, we're not going to say Phoenix can't grow. We're not going to stifle growth through the use of this coming to the nuisance doctrine, which it does have a tendency to do. But we're going to fashion the remedy. We're going to take that into account, the fact that you were here last and the other guy was here first. And so you have to help him find a new place, even if that means financial assistance. So there's an interesting approach to coming to the nuisance, and that's the part of the bill that I wanted to talk about a little bit today. I just wanted to bring it out sort of on the record and to everybody's attention that this bill adopts the coming to the nuisance doctrine as a complete bar to a plaintiff who's aggravated by the noise. And that, frankly, is not the doctrine that's shared by the judiciary at large in the United States. This concept, first of all, coming to the nuisance, what are we saying? A person may complain about another only if the complainant was there first. And in this case, a person may complain about noise at an established facility only if that person acquired his property before the noisemaker started. This bill on page 2, section lines 8 and 9, completely bars the person. I'm looking at the language, page 2, line 8, the clause starts, a person may not bring a nuisance action for noise level against a facility located in the vicinity of the person's property if the facility was established before the person acquired the property. That's the clause. Now, in deference to the sponsor, there is the unless clause. So if there's a substantial change in use, you can still bring your cause of action. It's not a complete bar for if there's a change in use. And it's not a complete bar if there's something other than noise. But if the noisemaker was there first and he doesn't engage in this substantial change in use, it is a complete bar. And frankly, the judiciary has rejected that concept of it being a complete bar because it tends to stifle growth. There was the question before, well, can the environmental groups use this to stifle growth? I would submit to you that the case law stands for the proposition that this type of complete bar is what stifles growth. And there's some interesting quotes in the treatises, but the bottom line is that the courts say, well, this is a factor to consider in A, the burden of proof on the plaintiff, and in B, the remedy. We won't completely prohibit you from bringing an action because, after all, nuisance is unreasonable interference. And if there's unreasonable interference, we'll allow you to come to court. But we're going to take into account that this interference existed before you got there. So I wanted to make that clear, or make that known at least, that this bill adopts a somewhat atavistic approach to real property management, and a concept that is generally rejected in the judiciary in favor of saying that a person who brings a nuisance action for noise level, not a person may not bring, but a person who brings a nuisance action for noise level against a facility located in the vicinity of the person's property must demonstrate that the noise is grossly unreasonable unless the facility substantially changes. That's what the courts generally do. Extra burden on you, Mr. Plaintiff. You came in. You're Del Webb. You came to Spur Industries. We're not going to say Phoenix can't grow, but extra burden on you. Demonstrate that it's grossly unreasonable. So that was the sum and substance of my pitch. Switching briefly to other cases, y'all had talked about disclosure, and if the facility is shut down, the disclosure case in Alaska is Bevins v. Ballard. It's a state Supreme Court case out of 1984, I think. It's either 82 or 84. But the scope of the duty is not to engage in negligent misrepresentation. So if I was a broker or a salesperson and I said, or even a seller of land, and I said, oh, got a real nice, quiet piece of property, knowing full well that there's this grandfathered airport or shooting range, now I've broached or breached the disclosure requirements. I've engaged in negligent misrepresentation. But there's no duty on me to say, oh, by the way, you've got a really noisy neighbor and you can't do anything about it, see AS 3475. Okay, so that's the scope of the duty. Is you can remain silent, and if the facility isn't, in fact, if there's no planes landing or there's no shots going off, you're not going to know, and there's no obligation on the broker to tell you. Neither in the Real Estate Commission disclosure form nor in the in Bevins v. Ballard. It's just, if you say anything at all, you can't misrepresent what you say. The question had, or the comment had been made, that in Alaska, because of our lifestyle, we ought to afford exceptional immunity. And it was wondered aloud whether or not that could be done. I submit to you that that is what the bill does in lines 8 and 9 on page 2, is afford exceptional immunity. And if that's the decision of this body, well, then fine, so be it. I just didn't want to have that being done without everyone understanding fully what it is that's taking place.
Representative Roquard?
No. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Regis, the Bevins v. Ballard was modified by the disclosure legislation, which was subsequent to the case.
And that is, right. Mr.
So,
Chair.
My ignorance there in answering you, in fact, answered out of both barrels, though, even without the disclosure legislation, Bevins wouldn't apply. But you're suggesting that the disclosure requirements now would not apply if there's a period of inactivity? Was that your point, versus a period of activity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roquard, it's my understanding, let me preface this by saying I do not work with the disclosure statute on a daily basis, right, but I have had occasion to work with it recently, that the disclosure legislation essentially codifies Bevins v. Ballard, and it doesn't actually go as far as most of the brokers and salespeople go in light of Bevins v. Ballard. For instance, the legislation only deals with residential property, and most discriminating brokers now make disclosures even as to commercial property. But it's my understanding of that legislation and the case that neither one requires an affirmative disclosure of what your neighbor is doing. So if there's an unreasonable interference, a nuisance in the vicinity of your property, I don't believe that legislation requires its disclosure. It's in defects in the property being transacted.
Or, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up.
Yes, Representative Roquard.
If the agent wasn't aware of the defect, that protects them under the new disclosure law, vis-a-vis the Bevins case. But I think in this case, unless there's a small shooting range or something that's maybe hidden away, generally it would be obvious to a casual observer that there would be some activity there during an active period.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roquard, I believe the issue came up in the context of a facility that was dormant for some period of time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And my comment would be there would be no obligation on anyone to alert the potential buyer that he was walking into this situation and that he would not thereafter be able to do anything about it, because unlike the judiciary, the legislature had completely barred him from bringing an action.
So it's your opinion then that in that example that was cited, there would be no recourse if this is enacted?
Which example was that? I'm sorry.
That was the one that they shut down the gun club for 2.5 years or so, and the property is sold in that shutdown period, but then starts back up again after new owner has taken over.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would adopt the interpretation of substantial change in use that was espoused by Representative Berkowitz, that if I was the plaintiff, I would go in and say, well, Your Honor, what's here is simply the mere increase in the number of shots isn't a substantial change in use. But this is not a mere increase in the number of shots. There were no shots, and there was a, you know, it may have been established, but it wasn't operating. I guess I'd make my pitch. So I suppose the short answer is there would still be a cause of action under the unless clause, that is, if I could, the unless clause of page 2, mm-hmm. lines 10 and 11, if I could prove that there had been a substantial change in use. I would have to focus my litigation on the substantial change in use language, as opposed to acknowledging that I'd come to the nuisance and carrying a heavy burden and perhaps demonstrating that it was, you know, grossly unreasonable, some other burden, or fashioning a remedy. That's actually what more courts do, is fashion the remedy to accommodate this concern.
Representative Roker?
Would you pursue that within the three-year period of dormancy, though?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vroberg, I believe under Section 3575.020, you have 3 years from the change in use. So that'd be page 2, line 16. Actually, within 5 years after the facility is established or begins, or if the action within 3 years after a substantial change, lines 16 and 17. So my argument would be, they started shooting. They weren't shooting when I got here. Nobody told me there was a shooting range. It looked like woods to me because there's a buffer zone. Lo and behold, they start shooting again. I complain. I try to bring a nuisance. People say, no, you can't. You're barred under this. I look at the statute. I say, well, my only avenue is to prove there's a substantial change in use. I have 5 years from the date they started shooting again. That would be my argument, is that the substantial change in use was the recommencement of shooting.
Representative Berkowitz, you can see this wheels are turning, but the lights are on, but there's nobody home right now.
I'd also like to say that the 5 years, it seems to me, be somewhat dependent on what tort rules were existing under.
I haven't been tracking that.
No.
But I have a question for the sponsor, I guess, inspired by some of your comments. The intent here is to limit nuisance actions.
Mr. Chairman, is to provide.
Why don't you come back up so we be sure we get that? Just pull another chair up if you wouldn't mind, Rhett. We probably will have some more questions.
Is there any more witnesses?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, the intent of this bill is to provide some assurance of facilities that are addressed in the bill, sports shooting ranges and private airport facilities, that they're going to continue maintaining those facilities for that use without, and to that end, provide limitations on the amount of noise nuisance or noise ordinance activities that they'll fall under after the fact.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
The front paragraph in the bill gives me a little concern then, because I think it goes far beyond just describing nuisance actions. Sweeping. It's anything that could possibly have an impact, even existing regulations or statutes that could impact an action against a shooting range or an airport facility would somehow be swept away by this language. And it seems to me that's going farther than you intend to go, or further than you intend to go.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berkowitz, I'd ask you to explain that to me further.
Well, you said,
as I'm looking at Section 1, it's limitations on actions arising from noise level.
Okay. Notwithstanding AS 945-230, that's a nuisance level, and AS 1161-110, that's disorderly conduct, and any other state or municipal law. That's as wide as it goes.
Right. Mr. Chairman, if you continue that, a person may not bring civil or criminal action against a person who operates or uses a sport shooting facility or a private airport facility if the action arises out of noise level.
Representative James, on that point?
Yeah, funnels it down right back to where And I assume that in these two others, there is the case of noise as part of it, not all of it, but could be a part of it.
But my concern is today, and I don't know, I don't have a hypothetical in mind, but today there could be a cause of action I could have against one of these facilities that's protected, and it's a legitimate cause of action. But tomorrow, after we pass this legislation, that cause of action will be barred because this language is so sweeping. It goes beyond just simply someone moving to the nuisance.
Mr. Chairman, may I give you a hypothetical?
Sure.
And this is off the cuff, so if it's
too absurd. Re-identify yourself for the record, please.
Robert Regis from the Department of Law. For instance, the prohibition in A does not apply to personal injuries suffered by a person while on the premises. Let's assume somebody next door suffers some sort of personal injury from the noise. He's barred from bringing that action under any state law, regardless of tort reform. Whatever the tort program may be, you couldn't bring it.
But that
arises out of noise.
Whereas, if I might,
Berkowitz.
Whereas currently that cause of action could be pursued. If I live next door to a shooting range and it's too loud, and you know my hearing goes, I currently could bring a suit in court based on personal injury arising from the noise level. Now, that would be the theory of the case. Whereas once this is enacted, I'd be precluded from bringing that cause of action. I could no longer say, I've been living next door to this shooting range, my hearing is deteriorated over a period of time as a consequence, this is not a nuisance action, this is a tort action. I mean, this is a specific personal injury action, not a nuisance action. This would bar any action on my part.
And Mr. Chairman, in the hypothetical situation Representative Berkowitz put forward, I would concur with what he said. This would bar that action. But I think, Mr. Chairman, it's also important that we get back to some basic premises. We're talking about a lot of hypotheticals and possible eventualities, but there's a basic premise that at some point you made the choice to buy and live in the property next to that shooting facility. There's certainly other ways that you could go about precluding having resulted in that hearing loss.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, under that hypothetical, you're barred whether you came there first or later. The limitation on the bar in subsection A is not limited to people who came to the nuisance. That's in subsection C. So if you could have been living there since before the shooting range started. If your hearing was impaired, you would not have a cause of action because of this bill.
Representative Brookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a provision in the Section 2 for a transition date where you do have the right to bring a cause of action. I think that it speaks to the timing here. So if you want to bring before the effective date, is the effect of this Section 2 to allow a cause of action to be brought within the five-year period or something, or how does this work?
Section 2 basically says that this is not retroactive. Any cases that are in the pipeline will be determined as if this law was not on the books. After the effective date and the passage and implementation of this act, however, future, it's prospective in nature. That's what Section 2 does.
Okay. But, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rookberg.
Well, I'm reading, if I would, the black letter law of this time frame now, that the only period here that you could bring a cause of action, unless you could prove the substantial change, would be after a three-year period of dormancy. You know, if it started up again after that three-year period had lapsed, then you'd have the right to bring a cause of action because of failure to meet the time frame. Other than that, then the bar is in place. That thing's quite clear here, the way it's drafted.
Mr. Chairman, unless it meets one of the three,
right,
subsection one, a contract of personal injury,
exactly,
suffered on the premises,
yeah,
right, or a substantial,
exactly,
change.
Right.
And that is the intent.
Is that true, though? I mean, I don't.
That's what it says to me, and that's why I keep asking that question.
Right.
If I don't bring it within 3 years, I'm out.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, section 020 here, the first phrase, person may not bring a nuisance action otherwise allowed under this chapter. Is your statute of limitations here in line 13 only for the nuisance actions?
Applies to the nuisance.
Okay, so it's not for a contract action under B1 or B2. In other words, if I have a contract action, my statute of limitations for the contract breach arising out of noise is still whatever the 6 years that's provided in the statute.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Do that one more time. You say that
I was trying to determine whether or not the statute of limitations that are established in 3575.020 would prohibit a person from bringing an action under the three exceptions, that is B1, B2, or B3,
mm-hmm.
particularly B1 and B2,
mm-hmm.
would limit it to bringing that action within 5 years after the facility is established or 3 years after a substantial change. And the answer that I got from the sponsor is no, it would not limit those causes of action into the first 5 years after it began operations or the first 3 years after a substantial change, because the statute of limitations section begins, a person may not bring a nuisance action otherwise allowed under this chapter,
right,
unless the action is brought within 5 years. So if I'm bringing a contract action, 3475.020 does not apply. If I'm bringing a personal injury action, 3475.020 does not apply. And the statute of limitations that are otherwise established in the law control the time period I have to bring those types of actions, which are preserved under B1 and B2.
Well, but my problem still exists, that if the operation is down and I want to bring an action because I'm a new owner of property, that this thing now is starting to make noise, it's not new, so it's not the 5 year, it's down to the 3 year portion. If I bring it after 3 years, I'm out of luck because it's a nuisance action. And if I bought this yesterday and the 3 year clock went out today, I didn't have a chance to file. Obviously that's a hypothetical, huh? That's a hypothetical. It's to the absurd, but still, it could take me 6 months to realize that I even have an action.
Mr. Chairman, I think my response there would be the same to Mr. Roepberg. You have to say, well, what was it that was the substantial change in use? Was it the cessation of shooting, the cessation of flights, or was it the recommencement of flights? Well, I think there's at least a reasonable argument. I'm supporting a bill I don't like, but I think there's at least a reasonable argument to say that the substantial change in use is when they recommence shooting. So you bought your house, you lived there for 20 years, and let's see, how long is establishment? 3 years is the maximum. So you live there for 2 years and 350 days, and they start shooting again. And so under the law, they were previously established because they didn't cease for more than 3 years. Now, I would argue, and I think you could prevail, on saying, well, the substantial change in use was the starting up of shooting again.
Right. So your three-year clock begins at the time that you
Except that, if I were the other attorney, I would say yes. However, for the prior 25 years, it was a shooting range. It was only down for 3 years. The substantial change is the down, is not the shooting.
And the only thing that's changed is an increase in the number of shots, and the mere change in the number of shots is not a substantial change in use.
So I've been had.
Yeah, that's certainly one possible outcome.
Well, I would think that what it says here, you may not bring a nuisance action, and if you want to do that, you almost have to get, if you have an argument against this, that when you bought, it was down, and, mm-hmm. and so to you, it's a substantial change in use. If that doesn't, the 3 years that says it's established is a whole different issue. It seems to me like for that person, that the returning of the shooting is a substantial change. Seems to me like that the court could sort that out.
I don't think that would fly. And I think we heard that from the attorney. But
Mr. Chairman, you might be able to fix that concern in the definition of substantial change in use. As was noted by the sponsor's representative, there's been a lot of discussion in this committee about the dormant facility that recommences.
Mm-hmm.
perhaps that's where it should be addressed, is in, say, you know,
okay, but it,
recommencement is the substantive.
But it's in, it's on line 11 that that's where that's protected.
Page.
Your cause of action is protected, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Representative, your cause of action is protected, but you have this concomitant statute of limitations. So just because you have a cause of action doesn't mean it hasn't expired. And I think what's trying to have, what we're groping with is how to prevent your cause of action from expiring before it really accrues.
I see what you're saying.
Mr. Chairman, I point out that this this addition of the substantial change of use was added as a Senate floor amendment, so this is really hasn't had any debate in committee. Is that, would that be a fair assessment? The questions you, the chairman,
Mr. Brought Chairman, Representative Roper, I don't think that's a fair assessment, because actually the substantial change in use was debated in the Senate Resource Committee when the bill sponsor brought back a resource CS that incorporated substantial change in use. At that time, the committee felt uncomfortable with adopting that CS because there was no definition of substantial change in use. And what you get to is, if you make exceptions for every possible avenue that's being explored, you don't want the bill. It's certainly the intent of the bill to provide additional immunity for these facilities. The Resource Committee failed to adopt the CS, even though the prime sponsor chairs the committee that brought the CS forward, because they felt like it was limiting what this bill was trying to accomplish to too great an extent.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that you can read between the lines and make this come out any way you want, but it seems to me like that the intent is okay. And the intent, of course, up on line 11, where it indicates that when a person may not bring a nuisance suit, and that was because it was already there, unless a facility changes after you acquired the property. And then when it goes down and refers to established, we're talking then about the time limitation on nuisance actions, and established being resuming sporting shooting activity. But what if there was an acceleration of the shooting activity or that sort of thing? I can see why there is a little glitch in that, and I don't know if there's a way to fix it. But I think that we could add in also that the change, the same thing, that the substantial change in the same language that's on line 11 could be included in the time limitation on nuisance actions and preclude the door from being shut a day after the resumption of the activity. I think it is important that we have that 3-year time frame of that statute of limitations for bringing a suit. And it seems to me like that there could be a unless on in the time limitation that is also up in the bar of the filing of the suit, that would indicate that the time is established is the established point or 3 years from the date of their purchase of the property. It could be one or the other. Well, that's what it is now. No, it could be 3 years from the time that the resumption was, if they didn't have the property over a period. There's a way, I think, of putting that in there.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I could, one of the difficulties that the committee's running into was somewhat of the difficulty that we ran into in developing the definition for substantial change in use. And the feeling of the sponsor is that there is no way that you're going to tighten this up in this legislative process to deal with all unique circumstances. And at some point, then that decision is left up to the court.
Yeah, it was.
And I think that's where we're at with the language that's in the bill now.
Brett, the change of ownership of property is frequent enough that you could have a lot of change of property ownership within the sound range of a firing range that was down for 3 years. What is it, every 2.5 years or something? I mean, it's really low on turnovers.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point something out right now from reading it. This we're talking about this three-year period of dormancy. Mm-hmm. The bill provides for a longer than the 3-year period of dormancy, but only allows the mover of a cause of action to bring the substantial change cause of action within a 3-year period after it was started up again. Is that
correct, Brett? Or begins operation. To me, that's when you start a new one.
It says 3 years or more. Does not use the activities for 3 years or more. So then the cause of action can be brought within 3 years after it recommenced. Like that's, is that a correct reading?
3475020 just deals with the time limitation on bringing the nuisance action.
Right. So what I'm saying is you could actually have a dormancy period for longer than 3 years.
I don't see where you're reading that, Representative.
Line 19. Does not been shooting activity at the facility for 3 or more years.
All right. There's no specified period of dormancy.
Right.
That's correct.
Just want to make it clear here.
Three years for shooting ranges, 3 or more for airports.
No.
It's 3 or more for either.
3 or more
yeah,
for both.
Yeah, it's 3 or more for both, but... established.
Because we're using this example on the record here, I just wanted to make that clear to everybody's mind, too, that the dormancy period could be for longer.
Okay, that is a good point, because then established on line 15 fits
the
this.
3 years is the period of which cause of action. Yeah. So in your example is when you purchase the property, it could be a dormant for any period of time, but after the reuse recommenced, then they have a 3 years to bring the cause of action. So that would protect the new property purchaser. He would have a 3-year window in which to bring the cause of action.
And I think that plays into the argument of, does resuming activity create, or is resuming activity a substantial change in the use of facility? And as you're making your case and preparing your cause of action, I believe the longer that the facility sat dormant, the more that would lean towards the person bringing the nuisance suit to say, yes, this thing hasn't been used in 25 years, and now they're shooting. I think it's easier to make the substantial change case.
Representative Porter.
Could you explain the effect of your section 2 on shooting ranges and airstrips that have been shut down now, and this law goes into effect?
I can't.
If somebody buys a piece of property after this law is in effect, but the range or airstrip was shut down before the law was in effect, where does that put that person?
Through the chair, Representative Porter, I believe where that would put them is back at, if they want to bring suit, bringing under one of the allowables in Section 1, Sub B, 1, 2, and 3, back to the substantial change in use of the facility.
So there is retroactivity in terms of the facilities.
That's a historic use. So. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, through the chair, and that's exactly the intent of the bill, is to grandfather.
I wanted to get that on the record.
That activity, certainly.
Any other? Yes, Representative Rutherford.
I just want to say that I agree with the bill sponsor's representative about the whole definition of what's a substantial change. That is up to the judiciary, and yeah, I think I'm satisfied with that.
Any other questions or comments?
This is Mr. Chairman. With respect to the last exchange with Representative Porter, I would submit that whether or not the bill is retroactive turns on when your cause of action accrues, as the language is used on page 3, line 20. And obviously there are various arguments as to when your cause of action accrues if the facility is dormant today.
The last person, it looks like Bishop, is Dick Bishop.
Like
there he
right
is.
Here.
Okay.
Yeah, looks like
it.
I didn't see you back there. Sorry.
That's the Bishop of Alaska.
Is that right? All right. Dick, would you give us your name, rank, and serial number and your testimony?
Yes, sir. I certainly will. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Bishop. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council, a statewide umbrella organization of outdoor user groups interested in sound conservation and fair allocation of use. And I'd just like to confirm that the Alaska Outdoor Council does support this bill. We feel that it is important. I was I really appreciate the committee's efforts in going over this bill rather carefully. Frankly, I thought it was perhaps overkill, but the more I listened to the discussion, the more important I thought it was that it was very carefully reviewed. And I was also trying to think of a situation that might be a real-life situation, since that seemed to be of interest. And I was kind of startled to realize that I am a real-life situation in terms of the shooting range that I happen to have on my own property. Years ago, when we first moved to where I live, we bought part of a homestead, and there was a hole in the woods which became a shooting range and has been ever since. Meanwhile, and that is 30 years ago, meanwhile the area around us has grown in terms of a residential area, and it is entirely conceivable that at some point in time, it hasn't happened up to the present, but at some point in time, a legal objection might be raised to my family's shooting on that land. And I think that this protection would be very helpful, because it is an important alternative for, as Representative James indicated, for us to be able to pursue our lifestyle, which does include shooting and related matters. So that is an example, and it certainly brought home to me the importance of this bill. The other comment I would like to make, and just one, is that I was particularly interested in the Department of Law's noting the prevailing opinion or view or posture of the courts with regard to nuisance actions, and that they generally didn't like to preclude them somehow. And I guess given the characteristics of how that was described, I think that makes it all the more important that this bill pass, and that once again the judicial system be obligated to follow the law, a law that is enacted in the best interests of the general public, rather than leaving the opportunity for the bench to interpret a vagary of the law as they see fit, which may not work to the benefit of the general public. I would certainly urge you to pass this law and help protect the interests of the public. Thank you very much.
Any questions of Dick? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bishop, I just suggest if you ever do spin off out in your land, you put a restricted covenant about this in the deed.
Thank you very much. I will take note of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I ask a lot of questions, and far be it from me to try and impede something like this, because in another life, in Baja, Oregon, there was an oil field in the Baldwin Hills where they have the big Hollywood sign that you see on TV a lot.
Oregon?
Baja, Oregon, California. I don't like to use that word, because California just conjures up all kinds of bad things, but there was an oil field there, and finally a gravel road became a paved road, and then houses moved in on the other side of the road and then imposed all kinds of restrictions to operations of the oil field. And that to me was, I don't know whether you call it taking, but it certainly was an irritation. And so I certainly support this kind of activity. It's just that I didn't want to have somebody come in and buy property and then get hammered because of the legislation that we passed here in that 3-year period, but I think we're covered. Let's hold just 1 second while we change the tape.
I want to make a comment, Mr. Chairman. I would have figured it.